And we're back.
Hello.
Let's see if there's any attendees I need to promote. That happens. Yeah, they're just watchers. Okay, we'll see what happens at this meeting.
Our issues, and we've been inundated. This office has been inundated with calls from the public on whether or not it's safe or not to go outside. We put together an air quality advisory, which is uploaded on our webpage, and it was sent to all the news media throughout the land. Supervisor Lopez's request, we're going to put together a short video that we can upload to our website. Hopefully we can get it done by the end of tomorrow, which will address some of these questions that we'll be receiving, explain a little better the air quality index. For those, just to remind you, we're not a wildfire monitoring agency. We're a regulatory air pollution control agency. So the monitoring results depicted on our webpage are typically a rolling average. And so they're not showing instantaneous results. So it is possible that somebody could be in really degraded air quality and our monitor will show that it's good. And the opposite is true. They could be in a really good air quality and the monitor will show that it's in dangerous levels. And that's just a reflection of the algorithm that's constantly doing the rolling average. We've complained to EPA and the state about this. It looks like we'll probably have to have two monitoring systems if we want to get instantaneous results on air quality at monitors. Once again, there's only one public health standard for PM2.5, and that's for a 24-hour exposure. That's why we do the rolling average. There is no instantaneous health standard for PM exposure. There's nothing less than 24-hour except for recommendations. So we're telling people to be judicious and use common sense when going outside. If it smells really bad and it looks really bad, it's probably pretty bad. Don't rely on a monitor or any other device to tell you not to go outside and run 10 miles or strenuously exert yourself in your yard or anything along those lines and to shelter in place. We're concerned, as I'm sure most of you are, that looks like the forecast is calling for a cooling trend, but then it heats up next week and we'll have subtropical moisture, chance of more lightning strikes, and as I said, hotter temperatures. So we might be in for a similar type of situation next week. So I'll move on to COVID-19. You know, we didn't meet last month, but I did bring the office back to work on a staggered basis for about a week. And then the governor's order came out that effectively closed down businesses again, except for essential services. So I ended up sending most people home. Working with the union, we identified the essential workers and their job descriptions that require them to be here, and most of that's administrative staff. So we do have a lot of administrative staff here. Our inspectors and air quality engineers and some other folks are actually working from home. It's a mixed bag. It's working well in some areas, and other areas we need some improvement. Our air monitoring guys are out in the field, especially right now because of what's going on. So we're most of the admin staff, including myself, have been coming to work every day. So we've got a lot of procedures in place. We've got a lot of cleaning supplies. When this is all over, maybe we can go to eBay and sell some of them or save them for the next one. But we've also developed an action plan in concert with the union on how that provides details on how we would deal with a COVID-19 case should it be suspected or happen here at work. Also, just on engineering, let me move on. We've held a public workshop on August 12th to discuss proposed revisions to our Rule 426, which is architectural codings. We had 7 attendees and received a few comments. Most notably, one of the attendees was from the American Coatings Association in Washington, D.C. He's very interested in the work we do here and has been for several years. We've received written comments from CARB as well. And we'll be putting this rule on our September board agenda, so you'll get to see what that's all about. We're also working with the state on what's called the Emission Inventory Criteria and Guidelines Regulation. Basically, CARB is requiring small business to submit yet even more information to protect public health. We're a little bit dubious as to whether or not they've got a sophisticated enough database to handle the additional workload. And it seems to be a little bit draconian. So we've been commenting and working, and hopefully the state will at the very least delay implementation of this, because it seems like it's bound for failure right off the bat. UC Santa Cruz and Chevron Salinas River Cogen facility successfully completed their projects with the hearing board, and the hearing board approved variances for those. We're also making progress on our implementation of our new database with Acela. We're working with a consultant right now to create reports and specifications to allow monthly permit billing to come from Acela database rather than our accounting software. So that should be a huge leap forward once that happens. Planning and air monitoring, we've just installed or had a charge point install a DC fast charge station for electric vehicles in King City Shopping Center. This was used with our AB 923 funds through our plug-in Monterey Bay grant project. This fills the significant gap in EV DC fast charging along the Highway 1 corridor. So that's a nice move forward. Our electric vehicle incentive program ended on July 31st. We basically processed 387 applicants. And so we only spent 329,000 of the 400,000 that was obligated for that grant. So we have about 70,000 remaining. We're gonna hopefully roll that over into the new program this year. And probably one of the reasons we didn't spend it all is because we got started late this year, because Monterey Bay Community Power started their own program. We let them go first. We tried to dovetail and coordinate the programs together. And of course, COVID-19, I probably don't have to say more than that. That's probably another one of the uncertainties that figured into the deficit, or at least the not spending all the money down. So we launched the new program on August 1st, and so far we've received 26 applications, and we've obligated about $47,000. So it's getting off to a good start, so hopefully we can spend those monies down again this year. It's a more attractive and beneficial incentive as compared to the previous year. This year's wood stove changeout program is expected to launch in early September, so stay tuned for that. We'll provide you with additional information. We're having some hiccups with the state because they want all the wood stoves to go to low-income areas. And that's problematic, especially for people that don't own their own home. It's difficult for them to put in a new wood stove on a rental property. And then we're also been issuing the diesel emission engine and equipment replacement grant agreements, which includes the Carl Moyer Grant Program, the Community Air Protection Program, NOx remediation, and the farmer programs. Awards have gone out competitively, and we've got a number of farms in low-income areas, again, that have received monies to replace old dirty tractors with new clean-burning models. And so we've spent about $1.5 million in this area. We've got our zero-emission school bus program. Received about 26 applications. We've been able to fund 10 all-electric school buses, and those are delivered throughout our jurisdiction. That's also in concert with the money we received from Monterey Bay Community Power. And then lastly, in planning, the Air Resources Board, CARB, is conducting a routine audit of districts' air monitoring stations this week. We go through that on an annual basis, and we usually pass with flying colors. So nothing new there, I guess. On outreach, we've signed on with IntraVision for Spanish ads, and they're affiliated with a number of Spanish-speaking stations and TV and radio throughout the area. So we'll be able to reach a wider audience with our outreach. We also had our first newsletter letter that went out, and it was well received. The fall issue will be out in mid-September, and board members are invited to contribute. So if you have something you'd like to say about air quality, we'll definitely make a space for you in the newsletter. And lastly, I just want to talk about a hearing board. We have a couple of vacancies. We need a medical professional. It doesn't have to be a doctor, but somebody in the medical profession, and two public members to be on our hearings board. I guess we could nominate them, but ultimately it's going to be the board that has to approve these folks. So if you have somebody in mind, if you know a doctor, a nurse, a physician assistant, epidemiologist, anybody in the medical profession, that would be great. I'll be reaching out as well. And then if you have somebody in your jurisdiction that you think would be great to sit on this board, it's probably meets once every 6 months, if that. This is mainly to deal with variances, that deviations in permits. For instance, recently we had UC Santa Cruz. They needed to do some work on some generation facilities, so they had to emit more and bring in some surplus generators so they could repair their equipment and do some upgrades. So we give them the permission to basically violate the permit conditions, as long as they're doing it in a manner that is under a variance type of situation, such as an emergency or maintenance or something like that. So that concludes my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions if anybody has one.
Thank you, Mr. Stedman. Is there any questions from the board? Any questions from the public? Seeing none, thank you very much for a very thorough report.
Yeah, I think you skipped over item four, which is non-agenda public comment.
Yes, I was going to circle back to that right now. So we'll go to item four, the public comment. And this is for items that are not on the today's agenda. Is there anybody from the public that would like to make comment to the board? Seeing none, we'll move back to reports by the committee chairs on committee meetings. Budget, personnel, and nominating committee. Do we have any reports?
Mr. Chair, we did not have a quorum today, so we do not have a report out. And on IMB, the advisory committee did not meet this month.
Very good. We'll move on to number six, comments and referrals from the chair and board members. Do we have any from the board? Seeing none, we'll move on to the consent agenda.
Chair, if I could, we would like to adjourn into closed session at this time because I sent out a notice of memo for the closed session and alerted the board members that we wanted to adjourn into closed session before you got to your regular agenda. So with the chair's permission, I would ask the directors and the appropriate staff to log out of this meeting. Please log into the meeting with the invitation that I sent previously. If you don't have that, let me know and I will send it again. And we will convene in closed session for a brief discussion. Does everybody have the invite I sent? I can resend it if necessary.
Yeah. Would you please resend?
Yeah, resend to me. I'm sure I lost it in the process. So
you may want to look at your calendars because Les calendared it on Outlook and the links are there.
Right, and I calendared it for 1:30 to 2:30. So...
And you sent that yesterday, right?
Sent that last week. I think it was Friday.
Friday, okay.
Because all right,
I just sent it to this computer and put it on.
Yeah, I just sent it again.
Is there any directors that would like to pull any of the items on consent? Seeing none, is there anybody from the public that would like to see any items from the consent pulled?
Move approval of consent.
Second.
All those in favor, say aye.
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 Roll call.
Roll call.
Okay, roll call. You're right.
Okay. When I call your name, please answer yes or no. Director Carbone?
Yes.
Director Friend?
Aye.
Director Dillis?
Yes.
Director Ledesma?
Yes.
Director Lopez?
Yes.
Director Parker?
Yes.
Director Phillips?
Yes.
Director Botello?
Yes.
The motion passes.
Okay, very good. Move on to the regular agenda. Receive a fiscal year 2020-21 AB 2766 applicant summary and staff recommendations. Mr. Stedman.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the board. If Alan is present, Alan will be giving a presentation on this item, but just to tee it off, this is this time of year where we've processed all the applications received for funding the AB 2766 program, which is for public entities, cities, counties, and other public entities. Typically, we'll get those tallied up. We do cost effectiveness, and then we rank them, and then we'll present to you our preferred nominations, and you have a chance to question us and dig a little deeper into how these decisions were made, and you'll have the opportunity to have a final say on what projects get funded, and we will bring that to you in September. So without further ado, Alan's got a nice presentation to get you up to speed on this.
All right, good afternoon, Board of Directors and Pro Tem Chair Botello. Hope everyone's staying safe. These are some really crazy times. But I'm here today to present to you our fiscal year 2021 AB 2766 Motor Vehicle Emission Program. I need to share my screen. I'll do that now. Let's do it this way. And hopefully you can see that now. Let me know. Can you see that?
Yeah, yep. We see it.
Perfect. So let me see if I can keep this going here. Yes, a little bit of background. I do this every year just for the benefit of new members. The AB 2766 program allows local DMVs to be collected, and they are used to solicit and fund cost-effective motor vehicle direct emission reduction projects pursuant to the California Health and Safety Code. This particular fiscal year, 2021, represents 30 years the district has opened and funded this program to date, with over $36 million and over 600 projects. We came to the board, your board, in April to present the program, and there were a couple of additions to it. One of them, we have two basic programs involved here, a clean air management program, which is typically roundabout design and construction, the use of adaptive traffic signal control, and the new part, the new component to this program was the advanced clean transportation, focusing on electrifying medium to heavy duty trucks in our district fleets. The second program is clean vehicle, two components there. The EV voucher replacement program is an incentive program for public agencies to electrify their fleets. And we have, of course, the Monterey Bay EVIP for residents of the three counties. So far we've done, as Richard mentioned, 387 for a total, cumulative 4-year total of over 1,100 vehicles that we've incentivized. So going forward, the way that we distribute the clean air management program is done by population distribution by county. And that's been relatively stable over the last several years. 57% of all the entire population is in Monterey County, 35% in Santa Cruz, and 8% in San Benito. The clean vehicle program, its components, the EV vouchers and the EV incentives to the public, they're funded a little bit differently. The incentives to the district public is done with a separate budget. and the EV vouchers to public agencies comes out of the allocation for clean air management. And it looks like this. So typically we've set aside this year 1.6 million for our clean air management program. And we've set aside another 400,000 for the EVIT program to the public. Allocation by county, once again, by population distribution, you can see the totals there. A little over 900,000 for Monterey County, 565,000 and change for Santa Cruz, and 132,860 for San Benito, for a grand total of 1.6 million. Total funding requests by county, and this has been a little different this year, something we haven't seen in quite a while. We had zero requests from San Benito. We had $906,000 in requests from Santa Cruz County and $1.2 million in requests from Monterey. And we believe that obviously COVID-19 has impacted us in several ways socioeconomically, but we feel that that was probably a pretty good contributor not having a fielding a response from San Benito County. Typically what we do is we rank our clean air management programs using a formula and methodology that was established by the Air Resources Board, and it is specific for evaluating motor vehicle registration fee projects, which are DMV projects, and also congestion mitigation and air quality improvement, or CMAQ projects. And periodically, these tables get updated. And so the last revision of the table is 2019, which we use to evaluate our projects. So looking at the six eligible projects that came in under clean air management, we've got three from Monterey County and three from Santa Cruz County. And if you look at the right-hand column on ranking, top of the list are typically adaptive traffic signal control projects. They usually yield very good emission reduction. Monterey, with their project coming in at 1.39, Salinas coming in at 0.84, and 0.43 for the electric bus application from MST. Over in Santa Cruz County, another adaptive traffic control project that yielded the highest of the three projects. Next in line was Santa Cruz, City of Santa Cruz, for their Class 8 electric refuge truck. And then lastly was UC Santa Cruz looking to fund an electric shuttle for their bicycle population. Going forward, you have an analysis that breaks down in detail the projects that were eligible for funding. Staff and management have collaborated, and we've come up with a recommendation for projects. We'd like to recommend that we fund the two projects out of Monterey. That would be both adaptive traffic signal control projects, and two projects out of Santa Cruz, one being adaptive traffic control, and the other one being the electric Class 8 refuse truck for the City of Santa Cruz. We also had two voucher applications come in for public agency. One of them was from the County of Santa Cruz General Services at $10,000. And the other one from AMBAG at another 10 for a grand total of 20, which puts us at a deficit for funding. We'd like to recommend still funding these voucher incentive projects. So that $20,000 can actually come out of the fiscal 19-20 EVIP remaining funds. As Richard mentioned, we have about $73,000 left over. We could take, staff would recommend taking $20,000 of that to fund these voucher projects. Board allowing that the board allows the rollover of the funds. And that's on this particular agenda for this month's meeting. One thing about AMBAG, we funded them a car quite a while back. It was just a Prius hybrid, and our neighbors could certainly use another one. So we would recommend funding the AMBAG vehicle, even though they have no vehicle to replace it with, unless I think Upendra Patel is willing to scrap his Mercedes-Benz. That might work. And then lastly, I wanted to kind of highlight the importance of incentivizing funding for fleets, public or private, that are classified as heavy duty. This comes from the California Air Resources Board, their fact sheet on an upcoming heavy duty low NOx omnibus regulation that will come before their board in October. If you look at the pie chart, 31% of all of the NOx emission in the state of California comes from on-road heavy duty diesel and gasoline vehicles. And you can see that 43% in the gray come from other mobile source emissions. And then the rest of it is stationary sources at 21 and area wide at 5%. So the majority of all the NOx in California, so at 31 plus 43, that's 74% of all the NOx emission comes from motor vehicles. And what I wanted to do is give you a real quick video to show the importance of electrification. This is an electric refuse collector, all electric.
No, it's not showing the video.
Music's very upbeat.
Supposed to use your imaginations.
Yeah, nice and clean too, notice?
I think you have to stop sharing your screen and then reselect the screen with the video on it, because all we see is the pie graph.
I hope your French is good.
Well, Alan, we can send this out to the directors as yep. well.
It's almost over.
Yeah. Okay, with that, is there any questions or comments from the directors on the presentation? Is there any comments or questions from the public? If not, thank you, Alan. Very good report. There's maybe a video right there.
Chair, there's a hand up in the attendees. Lisa Reinheimer has her hand up.
Oh, okay, great. Lisa, go ahead.
I think that Ann needs to unmute her.
Hang on, for some reason she wasn't showing up in mine, so hold on. There we go, okay. All right,
come on. I hope Lisa's doing well, it's a long time.
Okay.
I think I can, okay, I see I can mute myself, so that must mean you can hear me.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, great, yeah. Thank you for allowing me a few moments to comment here, and yes, Director Botello, it's nice to see your smiling face again. I hope you're doing well and safe over there in San Benito. Yeah, it could be worse, oh my goodness. Yeah, crazy times for sure. So the one thing I did want to mention is that for the MST project to purchase a zero emission bus, the challenge that we're having is that the California Air Resources Board instituted an innovative clean transit rule, which mandates that all transit agencies convert their diesel fleets to zero emission buses without any funding sources to come along with it. So we have an unfunded mandate to convert a fleet and at a considerable cost. And so the AB 2766 funds are one of the few available out there to help us achieve that goal. So I hope that you will keep this in mind in another round of funding possibly next year so that we can move to this goal. We have quite a number of diesel buses that, you know, with the amount of money that we have, it's going to take, you know, 80 years to replace, which is not where the Air Resources Board wants us to go. So keep that in mind for next go around. I definitely don't want to get into the adaptive signal projects are unworthy. I don't think that they are worthy, but we do need to be in line at some point to help convert our fleet to the zero emission buses. So with that, I'll leave it there. And Anthony, nice to see you again.
Nice seeing you too, Lisa. Good to hear from you. Anyone else from the public would like to comment on this item? If not, we'll move on to the next agenda item. Thank you, Alan, for the report.
We need a motion on this?
I don't think there's any action from what I'm seeing.
This will come before you later on at the next meeting.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Richard, you want to introduce the next item 15?
Yeah. So thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the board. as we're constantly improving around here with databases and record retentions, we're looking for the board to adopt a resolution approving our new records retention schedule that identifies certain categories of records in our document system and their required retention period, and authorizes the destruction of records following our procedures without board action, and adding two new policies to MBARD's administrative policies and procedures manual. And this will be effective if approved as of today. So Amy Climo is here to give a presentation.
Good afternoon, everyone. Let's see here. Can you see my presentation?
Yes.
Yes.
Awesome. Okay. So, as Rich mentioned, I'm going to go over with you today our update to our retention schedule and then two associated policies. So, first, I just wanted to start with kind of the perspective of why we're doing this now. So at our all staff retreat in May last year, we talked to staff about our goal that we'd like to achieve operating a nearly paperless agency within 5 years through investing in tools to more efficiently store, retrieve, process, track, and provide access to information both internally and externally. And one really important step in that process is if you're going to be storing records in an electronic document management system, like we're going to move forward with LaserFiche, it's really important to know how long that record should stay in that system. And our retention schedule was last updated in 2010. And so it seemed like 10 years later, we needed to take another look at it before we start putting stuff, you know, investing our time, putting things into this document management system. So we're going to start with that today. That is an important first step for us. So as I mentioned, it's been 10 years since we've updated our retention schedule. And then in 2017, we updated our admin policies and procedures manual. And so since that time, there's been the potential for some regulatory changes or other kinds of changes that we want to incorporate into our retention schedule. And we felt it was important to have it in a place like our policies and procedures manual where people would easily have access to it and know where to find it. And so to move that ball forward, we established contracts with a consultant to help us create the retention schedule. And then we've contracted with another consultant to help us get ourselves set up in LaserFiche once we're ready to roll that out. And I know, for example, David's been really successful in planning with eliminating all of the paper associated with the EV applications. They've been able to do an online application with the LaserFiche forms. And so we're already seeing some great benefits from that tool. So I just wanted to briefly go over some items from our 2010 retention schedule so you can get an idea of how that looks. And then how it will differ a bit from what we're proposing for our retention schedule and some of the areas that we wanted to update. So to start, we had some categories in our 2010 schedule where you can see here, accounts receivable, accounts payable, fiscal years plus five, same references. So we, in our new schedule, are looking to combine things that are similar into one row instead of two. Another was we have differing timelines in our current our 2010 schedule. Sometimes it'll be fiscal year plus a number of years or calendar year plus a number of years. That can make it a little more difficult to remember or figure out how long am I supposed to keep a document. And then we also wanted to add some more specific federal, state, or local citations. This is just an example. You know, there's just one citation for each category. And you'll see in our new schedule, we have expanded upon the citations for each retention period by record type. So our new record retention schedule was put together for us with help from a consultant called Kaizen InfoSource, LLC. And this is a consultant that has experience with helping other public agencies update their retention schedules. We heard about them through a public records request or Public Records Act training, and thought it would be really important to have someone help us put this together that had experience, that knew what the regulatory environment was, to get us started on the right place. And so we could reflect all of the current regulations that should be in our schedule, and really help us try to, where possible, make it somewhat easier to implement than our current retention schedule. And so we did an iterative process where they put together some ideas based on our current schedule and what they've done for other agencies. Then we had each department review the categories and timelines and citations to make sure that we didn't miss anything. And so we had some back and forth as we created this updated retention schedule. So this is now showing you a screenshot of what our new schedule looks like. And you'll see at the top, we have, at the top of every page actually, it has this bar where it explains all of the abbreviations and acronyms, what those mean. And then, as I mentioned, we were able to combine like categories. If accounts payable and accounts receivable are covered by the same department, they have the same retention schedule and the same citations, well, now those are just one category on the schedule. And then we also, all of the retention timelines, which are in this column, say in, for example, this says 7Y, so that means you keep it for 7 years. And so we got rid of that fiscal year, calendar year confusion. And then we also updated our regulatory citations. And so they're a little bit more descriptive than they were in the 2010 schedule. So once we had the schedule, it's just sort of a table, but it needs some policies to go around with it to help people understand how to use it. And it really requires everybody across the entire organization to buy in and understand how do you use it, and what are we going to do with this information. So to do that, we created two new policies to add to our administrative policies and procedures manual. The first one is number D9, and that's records management, and that's where the retention schedule will be housed. And then the second one is D10, and that's records destruction, and that describes the procedures that we will do in order to identify obsolete records and destroy them. So our first policy is records management. And this policy, as I mentioned, it defines what a record is. And to help people, sometimes it can get very confusing to understand what a record is. So we've got a definition. And then we also include examples of things that are called convenience information. And this is information, these are items that are not considered a record, and we wouldn't put them into our electronic document system. So it's things that are like identical copies of a document, working drafts, appointment logs. So trying to help people get an understanding of what needs to go into LaserFiche and what is not in LaserFiche, because that's where, when we get a public records request, we want to feel confident that if we search for it in LaserFiche and find it, that's what we give. But if it's not there, then we don't have a record responsive to the request. So the accompanying policy is, how do we now destroy those records when they become obsolete based on their retention timeline? So this policy has the process where we initiate, as determined by the APCO, at different times in the year when we're going to look for and destroy records. We work with LESS or other counsel if there may be any records that we would need to hold for some legal reason. Each manager then will be responsible in their department to go and figure out what records can be destroyed. And then we'll give a list to LESS or other counsel to review and make sure that they agree that none of those records have any kind of legal hold on them and that they are obsolete based on their retention timeline. And once we get that approval, then we'll be able to destroy those records. So again, I just want to end with these three items to you today. The updated retention schedule and two policies are really to help us launch the foundation that we need to get into our electronic document management system so that we can keep our goal that we started last year moving forward. So there's a resolution that we're asking you to adopt today. And as Rich mentioned, there is a part of that resolution where we're asking for approval to allow the APCO, if there are regulatory changes or other minor administrative changes that we need to make to the retention schedule, that we can make those changes without bringing it back to a full board. So with that, I'll take any questions.
Okay, thank you, Amy. Any questions from the board?
Jane Parker has her hand raised.
Thank you. Thank you, Anne. Thanks, Mr. Chair. Question about this. I thought this looked very thorough and it makes a lot of sense. A lot of good changes here and a good clear process. The one thing that I wondered about was, is there a reason why the annual or semi-annual process of clearing out these documents and destroying them as appropriate doesn't come to the board, say, on consent? It just seems to me that if these are potentially, since this is a public agency and these are potentially public documents, why wouldn't we take that transparency step of putting them on the agenda and so that the public can see what we're doing?
Les, do you think you could help with that?
It's a purely a policy call. The government code allows the delegation of this responsibility, which is what the proposal is. But if the board were to determine that you would rather have it on your agenda, at least as consent, that would be your call.
Thank you. I think that would be a good idea. But I'm open to what my colleagues might think as well.
Okay. Thank you, Director Parker. Any other comments or questions?
Director Dillis has his hand raised.
Yes, go ahead, Director.
Okay. This is great, by the way, well organized, and I know from experience that there are a lot of nitty-gritty details here, so good job on doing this. I am wondering one thing about emails. Is there any coverage for how long the district keeps emails and other what I'll call general correspondence?
There is a category, it's called general administration, I think, that is covered by every department, and it would cover email as correspondence type. Or if it's an engineering email related to a permit file, then it would go into that category. It's probably going to depend on what the content of the email is.
If it's specific, but is there a general overall how long you keep emails guidance on here if it's not in a specific category?
So we also have, it's referred in policy D9, I think it's D6. We do have an email communications policy in our admin policies and procedures manual that talks about if you have an email, you either have to print it if it's important and file it or delete it within a certain timeline.
Okay. And is it, can you give an example of how long that would be? I'm just curious if we're keeping emails for a long time.
I think it's 1 year. I can look if you'd like me to. It's 1 to 2 years.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Yeah. Great. Thank you. Any other directors want to comment or ask a question? Seeing none, we'll go to public comment. Is there any comments from the public? I guess not. So I'll bring it back to the board. Director Parker suggested that we, some of the documents to be destroyed on consent, just so there's an opportunity for the public to review them. Is there any other thoughts on that?
I'll go ahead and make a motion that we approve the staff recommendation with the addition that whatever the timeline is for this review and destruction, that the list of those documents be placed on the consent calendar of the Board of Directors meeting closest to the time before the destruction is going to happen.
Okay. I have a motion. Do I have a second?
I'll second Zach. Or we'll give it to Carbone. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay. Go ahead.
Okay. I have a second from Director Carbone. Roll call, please, Ann.
All righty. Please say yes or no. Director Carbone?
Yes.
Director Friend?
Yes.
Director Dillis?
No.
Director Ledesma?
Yes.
Director Lopez?
Yes.
Director Parker?
Yes.
Director Phillips?
Yes.
Director Botello?
Yes.
The motion passes on a count of 8 yeses and 1 no.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Amy, for a good report. We'll move on to item 16, accept and file a report on mid-year 2020 engineering and compliance activities. Mr. Stedman, you want to introduce your presentation?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the board. As you may recall, we used to give you an update on our act compliance and enforcement activities. In engineering activities on a board meeting basis. We've since changed that to 2 times a year. This represents our mid-year report on engineering and compliance activities, and Amy has a presentation to provide to you.
Okay,
here we go again. Okay, so this is our mid-year, so this represents January to June of this year. And so a big chunk of this time period, actually, we've been impacted by COVID-19. And so back in March, we had to adjust our operations for remote work. And so in engineering compliance, we initiated a remote inspection protocol in April to allow our inspectors and engineers that need to do inspections to do those via photographs, their videos, and documentation through email, so they didn't actually have to go to the site where the inspection would normally occur. And then in June, we began to, as Rich mentioned, at the end of June, we started to try to bring people back into the office and try to get our inspectors back into the field in places where we felt it would be safe for them to go, places where the equipment is outside and where they can maintain social distancing. So we've been trying to adjust along the way to keep safety our number one priority, but try to keep continuing to do our essential functions. So I'll just go over with you background on what engineering compliance, kind of what their responsibilities are, and then kind of where we are right now. So the engineering side of the house, they get the permit applications, review those, make sure that the equipment can operate in compliance with federal, state, and local regulations. They issue the permits with operating conditions, and then that's what gets handed off to compliance. They will also develop rules and regulations, and then we have our annual emission inventory, which is due August 1st of every year. So we're working on that a lot during the first 6 months of the year to collect all the data from the sources that we need to report data for calendar year 2019 in this case. So on the engineering side of the house, engineering is more easily adaptable to working remotely. We can easily scan application information. A lot of times people just email us scanned applications. And so getting those applications to our engineers has been fairly seamless. So our activity as it relates to getting applications, issuing the authorities to construct, which is the first step towards getting a permit, issuing permits to operate, these numbers are all in line with what we were achieving in, let's say, 2019, January to June. So we've been able to keep our workload up on the engineering side. I will mention that we did have an engineer leave us at the end of May. So since June 1st, we've had one less engineer. So we have currently three permanent engineers. And so again, just to give you an example, these are our numbers of permitted kinds of equipment. These are the top five. And we're continuing to see, I think, because of conditions like today, because of the power shutoffs, because of rolling blackouts, we're continuing to see people applying for permits for emergency engines. The numbers keep ticking up every year. But I wanted to share the pictures on the right side of the screen. Well, they're on my right side. I hope they're on your right too. Joby Arrow that's going in Marina. We have gotten a couple applications from them for equipment. And this is one of the pieces of equipment. So the picture on the bottom, it's called a computer numerical control cutting machine, and it creates a lot of dust. So the picture on the top is the actual dust control equipment that minimizes the dust going out of that stack before it goes into the air. So it goes from a piece of equipment at the bottom through the blue part and then out the stack. And so it really reduces any particulate matter from getting into the atmosphere. So we are still, although, you know, it's been tougher times, I think, we are still getting new sources and new applications and new kinds of equipment that we haven't seen before in the district. So on the compliance side, the majority of the responsibility of our inspectors is to do inspections and make sure all this equipment we've been permitting is doing what they're supposed to do to meet their permit conditions. And if they are not, then they are issued a violation. We also have an inspector that's in charge of making sure that when we get notifications for renovation or demolition projects, that those meet the federal NESHAP regulation for asbestos. And then we also respond to complaints. So this is where we did see a decrease in activity in the number of compliance inspections during this first year. And that's because we kept our inspectors working remotely for a portion of the time. And so we weren't out in the field for the first month and a half of when COVID hit. So we did get a decrease in inspections compared to last year, but we've been ramping that up since June and we're getting back on track with that. And I will also mention that we do have one less inspector this year. We didn't fill the position that we had open. So we are also operating with one less inspector at this time. But what we did see is the number of complaints is a bit higher this year. And it could be because people are around home and noticing things that maybe they didn't notice when they were off at work. But it's very common is that our two number one types of complaints are odors and smoke. And we've been getting a lot of odor and smoke complaints. And fortunately, we've been able to address most of those through phone calls, emails, communication. A lot of the smoke complaints are things that we don't necessarily regulate, like people barbecuing in their backyard. These are just an example of the kinds of complaint categories that we have. And so with that, I will conclude my presentation and take any questions.
Okay, thank you. Any questions from the board? Seeing none, I'll move over and take questions or comments from the public. Questions or comments, we do have to have a motion to accept this and file the report.
I'll move the recommended action.
Director Phillips, go ahead.
Yeah, I just curious from your standpoint, how effective do you think the remote inspections are going, and is at least a portion of that going to be able to be done remotely now?
Well, so we were able to focus on emergency engines. They're a really good category to do remote. We have, for example, Verizon has their cell towers all over all three counties. I think they have 40 or 45 permits. So that one worked really well because they get all of the data, the hours those engines operate are electronically transmitted. So the emergency engines work really well to do remote inspections. But there are, you know, as we go through time, we're going to sort of, I don't want to say run out, but we're going to have fewer of those kinds of sources where we're going to be successful doing remote inspections. But on an annual basis, these kind, you know, this would work as an option for sure.
Yeah. All right. Thank you. Thank you for the report.
Yeah.
And I'll second the motion if someone else has.
Okay. I didn't catch the maker of the motion.
It was Zach.
Okay, Zach. Great. All those in favor, go ahead for a roll call, Ann. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Please say yes or no. And just to note that Director Ledesma and Director Lopez have left the meeting. But we still have a quorum. When I call your name, please say yes or no. Director Carbone?
Yes.
Director Friend?
Yes.
Director Dillis?
Yes.
Director Parker?
Yes.
Director Phillips?
Yes.
Director Botello?
Yes.
Motion passes.
Thank you. We'll move on to item 17. Mr. Stedman, you could introduce this.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the board. Similar to the engineering and compliance activity report, we're doing a mid-year summary of our monitoring results. So David Frisby, who's manager of planning and air monitoring, will be giving that presentation. It should be fairly quick.
Good afternoon. This is the, as Rich said, the mid-year air monitoring summary for 2020. I wanted to point out one thing in the staff report. I somehow carried over a error on the name of the board, and I called you the MARD Board of Directors. So my apologies to that. I don't think there are any other errors in the staff report, but just want to make that clear. So moving on, this is a map of our air monitoring stations within our district. We've got 10 air monitoring stations operating within the district. Starting from the north end, you can see that we've got four stations that are all dedicated to PM2.5 monitoring. Three of them are seasonal to capture the wintertime wood smoke that's generated from the use of wood-burning stoves and fireplaces. The San Lorenzo Valley Middle School station is a permanent station that's representative of the general air quality in the San Lorenzo Valley. So we maintain that station year round. Five other stations that we have are operated by the district. We have, they're all monitoring ozone as well as PM2.5. I want to point out that Hollister and King City both monitor for PM10 as well. And the Pinnacles National Park station is actually operated by the National Park Service for purposes of monitoring the visibility in the park, which is considered a class one airshed. That coincidentally is our site that we have the highest concentrations of ozone, usually during the summer months. So these are a couple of our air monitoring stations, one in Carmel Valley and another in Salinas. They're either a shed or we use trailers to contain the equipment and maintain the temperature of the device. We're supposed to operate within a certain temperature range. We also have MET stations at all of our air monitoring stations as well. This is the inside of air monitoring station. We have instrument rack on the left side here. That's our ozone monitor. You can see on the back, and it looks simple in the front, but it's actually a lot of business in the back going on. So it's actually fairly complex, just trying to take samples and clean them and make sure that we're getting as accurate a sample as possible. On the right side, this is a particle monitor. It's a filter-based monitor that we use to check PM10, or PM2.5 rather. So these are the standards that, the daily standards that we go by, that we're trying to compare that what our air quality is with the standards. So we have California standards and national standards, and for ozone as well as PM 2.5 and 10. And I wanted to point out here that there's an averaging time for each of the standards. So there's, for ozone, there's a 1 hour as well as an 8 hour standard. So those are averaged, rolling averages. For PM 2.5 and PM 10, the standards are averaged over 24 hours from midnight to midnight every day. So for our hourly peak ozone, the standard is 90 parts per billion, and that's what this dotted line is establishing. You can see that in each of the counties, in Monterey, San Bernardino, and Santa Cruz, the first half of the year are showing no exceedances of the hourly peak ozone standard. Actually, we haven't seen an exceedance of the hourly peak ozone since 2012, so we're doing very well on that. The daily 8 hour peak ozone standard is 70 parts per billion. So it's an 8 hour average, rolling average. And we see that in Monterey, San Benito, and Santa Cruz counties that we haven't exceeded the standard for the first half of the year. So this is PM 2.5. These are all the monitors that we have year round, established year round. The PM 2.5 concentrations measure really what's you see in smoke. So it's really ultra fine particles. The first half of the year, we haven't seen any exceedances. I'm sure in August, the last few days, they've skyrocketed. So we'll see a lot higher concentrations in the second half of the year. And those are due to the exceptional events that we're seeing from wildfires. EPA will give us, if we document it and submit the request, they usually give us a break on exceptional events, so they won't count against us, and we won't have to pass further regulations to mitigate any kind of exceedances of PM 2.5. PM 10 concentrations these are the two stations that we have in Hollister and King City. We did get one exceedance on May 5th of this year. This is actually rather remarkable because usually we get, on a regular, just an average year, we'll get 30 to 35 exceedances of the PM 10 standards, especially in King City, because you get a lot of the entrained dust from ag fields that get kicked up from the afternoon winds that race down the valley. So our attainment status, as you can see on the far right, we're in attainment for all the federal designation for all the pollutants. And for the state designations, we were in non-attainment transitional for ozone because you have to have 3 continuous years of not exceeding the ozone standard. For PM10, as I said before, we're in exceedance, usually about 30 to 35 exceedance days per year. And so we're going to be in non-attainment for the state standard. And for fine particulate, there's only a federal standard. So we are in attainment for that as of now. And for the rest of the pollutants, we're either in attainment or unclassified. So I did want to point out one thing that's come up recently. Last year was a rather remarkable year for PM10 as well. in, you know, usually between, we'll see between May and November, those high numbers of readings that we get down in King City. But last year was fairly, I guess the prior season was really wet, and we didn't see a lot of dust being kicked up until November, October, actually late October. We were seeing a strange phenomena that where the state and surrounding areas, we were seeing this too, where the PM10 concentrations were rising due to a some winds, some transported winds from down the southeastern part of California. So we were getting a lot of dust coming up from there. Dust doesn't tend to carry so much, but we were seeing it, and so it was very strange. But what happened is we exceeded 120. So 120 is significant because it's 80% of the standard. So the federal standard is up here at 150. So we exceeded 120, which is 80%, which under 40 CFR Part 58, if you have one exceedance of 80%, then for our metropolitan statistical area, which we share with Santa Clara County, we actually have to install one additional PM10 air monitoring station, one permanent station for that one exceedance. It's in the law, so it's what we have to follow. So we've done some research on this, and we have a proposed new location for an air monitoring station in San Bernardino County, and that's at San Juan Bautista Elementary School. We've got permission from the school to install a station there. They're very supportive of it. We actually have a trailer that we don't have use for any purpose at this point, so we can use that. And the Air Resources Board is going to give us a PM10 monitoring device. So we are preparing to get set up at the San Juan Bautista Elementary School, and we likely will add a PM2.5 monitor so we can keep monitoring smoke as well at that site. So with that, if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them for you.
Thank you, David. One of the questions I have, as far as the location of the site of the San Juan Elementary School, it's right next to Highway 156. Is there air quality issues coming off of the highway that might distort what is really we're trying to monitor?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I have Bill. Would you like to come in?
Sure.
Answer that? Okay.
Yes. Bill is our air monitoring supervisor. He'll answer that question for you.
Okay.
Yes, in answer to your question, we're not expecting dust to be a big issue off the highway. We've had we're getting audited this week, and ARB, one of their auditors, came and examined the site as well and thinks dust will not be an issue off the highway.
Okay.
So that is something we're going to, you know, examine a little bit more. We're still in contact with the EPA. So we're going to discuss that site in particular with EPA and ARB just to make sure everyone's on board with that site for those reasons. But at this time, we're not expecting dust to be an issue.
Thank you. Any other questions from the board? Any questions from the public? Seeing none, I'll bring it back to the board for an action to accept a report and file it.
So moved. Actions.
Second.
A roll call, please, Ann.
When I call your name, please say yes or no. Director Carbone?
Yes.
Director Friend?
Yes.
Director Dumas?
Yes.
Director Parker?
Yes.
Director Phillips?
Yes.
Director Botello?
Yes.
Did I miss anybody? The motion passes.
Okay, very good. We'll move on to the last item of the regular agenda, receive an oral report on potential office relocation and provide direction to staff. Richard?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, this one's off out of left field, so I just have an oral report. I was approached by Monterey Bay Community Power. They are installing they've got a letter of intent signed with the property owner to purchase property. And all as I know, the location is somewhere in the Marina Dunes. And they asked MBART if we'd like to come along with them and possibly purchase some additional land and form a government center. Now, this is an idea I came up with when Monterey Bay Community Power was first forming, that it would be nice to get all the agencies together to share resources, especially like a boardroom, not having a lot of real estate. The only thing that compounds this is that, we just got through with 2 years of remodeling here at the district for about $2 million. I'm not sure we'll get that money out of the building or not, but there's the potential to situate ourselves in Marina, which is more centrally located as well. And I should also say that Community Power has contacted AMBAG, so they're trying to get our tenant to go with them as well. So I just wanted to take the board's temperature and see if you had any advice or direction. Before I started working on this type of scenario, I wanted to see if you had any input.
Well, all right, thank you, Rich. Any thoughts?
We have Jane Parker and John Phillips both have their hands raised.
Okay, we'll go with Director Parker first and Director Phillips second.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just some questions about, would we be a tenant? Would we own the building? Do we have any sense for or be part owners in it? Any sense for that?
Not at this point, but my feeling would be that we would own the building and that the government center, maybe there would be a centralized boardroom or something like that, would be owned probably by Monterey Bay Community Power, and we'd have to reach an agreement with them to use that. I think if we start commingling funds and all that, especially now that Community Power is going well beyond the three county jurisdictions that it originally had, that would be quite complicated. So we would probably look to maybe build next to them, but have some efficiencies built in so that we could share resources. I understand that Monterey Salinas Transportation is also interested, and they may be acquiring property out there as well to do just what I'm discussing. But as far as the specific details, without getting input from the board, I didn't want to go too much further. Plus, JR over at Community Power didn't have much to give me, and a real estate agent was supposed to actually call me and never did. So I just, as I said, wanted to take the temperature and see if this is something that's the board would entertain.
Yeah, it might be worth exploring to the next step to get a better idea.
Director Phillips?
You know, where exactly, you mentioned the government center, where is that?
So it would be, this is as specific as I've gotten so far. It's in the Marina Dunes area.
Close to the veterans clinic, the VA clinic, and there's some land around there that hasn't been developed yet. I can't remember. I think it's between the veterans clinic and the REI shopping center portion. Okay. But yeah.
All right. I got it. But I'd have some real concerns about that, only because we just dumped a lot of money into this building and to get it the way we wanted it and things. So I would have some real concerns about, and I don't see any real big advantage to the move, but
I'm open to hear other people's thoughts, but I am a little concerned. And then realistically, if we're going to do it, we have to be able to get out of our property what we have into it. That's not a good use of public funds.
Yeah, I hear you, and those are my concerns as well. I will say this, that for instance, AMBAG, the board, many of you are on that board, do not want to come to our facility because it's off of 68. It's very difficult to get to. So they still have their meetings at the library in Marina. And so they felt that even though they like the situation, the office situation here, it's very difficult for a lot of people to get to. And so one of the advantages that you could put is that it would probably be more accessible to the public. 68 is not going to get easier to commute on. I think we'd probably be able to get what we put into the building, but I'd have to do evaluation on the building and see where we're at as well. So if that's the board's pleasure, I could start collecting information without making any commitments, obviously.
Yeah, my only comments is I recall my days from serving on AMBAG, and it really put a burden on us when we were exploring moving up into a new building, and then the cost ran away. I think we need a little bit more information to kind of give a real good direction to you, Rich. I wouldn't rule it out, but I think we have to have a real good idea what you can get out of your current building and what needs to be invested in a new facility. That's my thought on it. Anyone else?
Yeah, I'll add something, Anthony. This is Zach. And Rich, I'm totally open to the exploration. I feel like the amount of information that you currently have, and this is not a commentary on what you brought forward, it's just the reality of the situation, is so limited that I can't really have an opinion yet as to whether this is even a good idea. So I'd rather just give you the direction to continue to explore it. The board has every ability to shoot down the concerns of both Anthony and John bring up are very valid about what we've put into it, but maybe it'll be a better deal and a better location and better serve our constituents moving forward. So I'm all for exploration, but right now I feel like there's so limited information I don't have an opinion. And I think the exploration would give me the ability to have an opinion moving forward.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. All right. Any other comments from the board? Any comments from the public? If not, I think you have a direction, Rich.
Thank you very much.
We'll go with that. And I guess our next regular meeting is September 16th, 2020. And we'll entertain a motion to adjourn this meeting.
So moved.
Okay, second. Carbone seconds, and I don't think we need a roll call for that. And I think
we're good. It.
Thank you very much for taking the time this afternoon, and it was a privilege to serve as your chair. I appreciate the honor.
Good job,
Mr. Chair.
Well done.
Thank you.